Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Kevin Featherstone, and I'm the head of the European Institute here at the LSE. I'm delighted to welcome you to tonight's lecture. Tonight's lecture is part of a well-established public lecture series organized by the European Institute entitled Challenges for Europe. And I'm delighted to introduce our speaker this evening. Of course, there's a number of reasons why we're interested in listening to the position of the Icelandic government and its recent experiences. We think of the financial crisis since 2008, the economic collapse in Iceland since then, and the recovery and the path away from crisis. So it's very timely for us to be considering the Icelandic economic progress since 2008. And as many of you may know, there's also an election coming up in Iceland in about 10 days' time. So this also has topicality. And from a British point of view, of course, following the Brexit referendum, then the UK is more interested in hearing about other types of relationship with the European Union, the European Union's relations with EFTA, the European Union's relations with a number of other European countries. So I'm delighted to introduce Lilja Alfredsdottir, sorry Very about good. The pronunciation. She is the Foreign Minister of Iceland, Minister for Foreign Affairs and External Trade. She comes with an impressive CV. She obtained her first degree in political science from the University of Iceland. She holds a master's degree in international economic policy from Columbia University. She spent many years as a central banker in Iceland, and she's also worked in the Prime Minister's office in Iceland as well. More particularly, since last April, she has been Minister for Foreign Affairs and External Trade. As is usual, in a moment I'm going to ask you to welcome our speaker. We will ensure that there is opportunity afterwards for a question and answer session, and so we will invite your questions at that stage. You can see that there is also a hashtag for this event, for those of you who tweet. I can't say that I do. I don't really understand what that is. But that's a generational thing, okay? But you can see the hashtag is LSE Iceland, so it's highly relevant. So without further ado, can you please join me in welcoming our speaker this evening, the Foreign Minister of Iceland.
Thank you very much, Professor Kevin. I'm delighted to be here this evening to hold my lecture on Iceland's road to recovery, the key lessons. As the professor said, this has the last 10 years in Iceland. They've been a very interesting time. And I've been a part of that, both as a central banker and then at the Prime Minister's office. And I was also working at the International Monetary Fund when we had our economic program as an advisor to the executive director of the Nordic Baltic office. So I was both working on the economic program in Reykjavik and also in Washington. So this is it's not my life story, but it's my story for the last 10 years. So Iceland's road to recovery, key lessons. I'm basically going to invite you for a short road trip, even though this has taken many years. This was a pretty bumpy and uphill journey for us, involved, as I will explain to you at the later stage, a complete collapse of our whole banking system and how we basically addressed that challenge. So I'm going to divide the lecture into four parts. First, I'm going to address Iceland and the global financial crisis. than the sustainable economic strategy that the authorities put in place, the outcome and the key lessons in my view. So just before we start, I don't know how familiar you are with Iceland, but this is a small nation with only 330,000. We got our independence in 1944, actually after we were occupied by the UK in the Second World War. Then Churchill needed some resources and the US came. And as a result of that, we kind of pressured the US to support our independence from Denmark, and we became independent in 1944. The GDP is not, $16.5 billion US dollars, GDP per capita around 50,000, and we have an independent monetary policy, and the current government, even though we have elections on October 29th, is a two-party center-right coalition. And very important, we now rank number 27 in FIFA. This was the highlight of my summer, by the way. Even though I was very busy as a minister, but I got the opportunity to see one game, not Iceland-England though. It was Iceland-Austria, which was a fantastic game. What we experienced from the years 2005 to 2008 was a boom like we had never seen in Iceland before. There was a lot of activity, economic activity, there was a credit boom, and a lot of optimism in society. We had the highest GDP ever since independence. So, we were kind of in a mood that there was basically no tomorrow. Like many other countries, Western countries at the time, there was ample global liquidity. And just to show you basically where we were at that time, the net government debt was close to zero. We had a 5% fiscal surplus, AAA rating, and even our banks had a AAA rating at the time. And the banks were very well capitalized. They were profitable, signed by all the five big auditors. There was high policy rate at the central bank because the economy was on such a, it was growing that fast, so there was a high policy rate. Pretty strong institutions, very qualified labor force. We had just established the inflation targeting framework in 2001, and we had a very good access. The banks had very good access to the ample global liquidity that was in the market. And we had, there was an IMF in town in June, basically, in 2008, and said enviable prospects. And guess what happened a few months later? But even though the economy and a lot of good things were going in our favor, there were a lot of growing imbalances taking place. In 2008, the current account was 26%. It had been growing, and I'll show you some figures later on. It had been growing quite a bit. But the justification was always that there was so much foreign direct investment that this would all balance out. It would all go through the FX market eventually. So, and because of these weaknesses, the currency started to depreciate, and there was also a strong capital inflow that fueled asset boom in our economy, and it continued to have strong capital outflow pressures, and then the currency started to depreciate. But the biggest challenge was that we had a really large banking system, about 11 times GDP. And the banking system grew from 2003 until 2008, about from being like triple GDP until being 10 to 11 times GDP. And this happened because there was a lot of ample liquidity out there, and they were in a lot of doing a lot of acquisitions in Europe. So. And there was a lot of concentrated risk and connected lending within the banking system, even though the surveillance authorities viewed them as strong and solid, and also the auditors. And this, we didn't realize this until they basically had collapsed. But the interesting thing is that they were very international. Like 70% of their assets were in FX because of the mergers and acquisitions that they took place. But because we had an independent currency, we didn't have a very strong FX reserves to support them and to the challenges that were ahead of us. And there was even a debate within the central bank, how large should our foreign reserve be? Because if it's completely, if there's a lot of borrowed foreign reserve, or you're going to support a banking system of this size, the sovereign will also go under. So already, I would say in 2006 and 7, there was a debate how large the foreign reserve should be in order how much it could support if it was only borrowed. Just an example how quickly they grew. So October in 2008, a very beautiful month usually in all countries, but there was a lot of tension in Iceland because we knew that the banks were challenged. There were some dates coming up for their obligations that were unfunded, and we all remember the global financial system was in a state of basically shock. It was not only the Icelandic banks that were into liquidity crisis. This was also happening in this country and a lot of other countries. There was dollar shortage between the U.S. And Europe, and a lot of challenges. It came for us in 1 week. The whole banking system collapsed, about 88% of it, and then at the later stage in March in 2009, the rest of it. Very dramatic. And a complete shock for the general public in Iceland, and of course the CEOs and the whole government. And this was also very large from an international scale. If we accumulate their assets, it's actually the second largest default after Lehman, which kind of shows you how the global financial markets were working at that time. Because if you could issue debt and you had the AAA rating, you were audited by the five big auditors, and what the Icelandic banks did, they were often in the structured financing, and they came into that, and they were able to acquire a lot of funding just by doing that. And this was very big compared to other commercial banks' asset in various other financial crises, as you can see. You can see that we are way ahead of Japan there, and Venezuela, and Turkey. So this was a huge challenge for the authorities to deal with. And just to show you in what kind of a state the economy was at the time, first you see the current account. As I said, it was about minus 26%. We had a very sharp depreciation of the currency, a lot of foreign net investment income, and then the unemployment rate also went up, skyrocketed. And in Iceland, we're not very used to having very high unemployment rates. For Iceland to go up to almost 9 to 10%, as was forecasted at that time, was huge. Just in comparison, now the unemployment rate is below 2%. We've usually always had a very strong labor market. And when we thought that nothing at all could be worse than having our whole banking system collapse, then we had a ISAFE dispute here in the UK, and a terrorist act put on us by the current government. And I even remember where I was in the central bank when the terrorist act was put on the Republic of Iceland, the Republic of Iceland and Landsbanki. And I was like, we don't even have an army. How can you put like a terrorist act on Iceland? But this was a dispute between the two countries on whether this was a sovereign obligation or whether this was an obligation by the private banks. Iceland viewed it was an obligation that should be financed by the failed state when it went into liquidation, while your authorities thought that the sovereign should step in. And this became a dispute between the countries for, when was it settled? In 2013, from 2008 until 2013. But then it went into the EFTA court, and which viewed that this was not a sovereign obligation. It was the banks that were supposed to pay out from their failed estates. So you can just imagine, the whole banking system has failed. We have an international dispute with no other than the UK. Terrorist act has been put on us. What does one do in a situation like this? You need to be a little bit creative. And so the first point of departure was to ring-fence the sovereign. We had had a AAA rating, and this is a country that has never defaulted on its sovereign obligations. So basically, to prioritize, we ring-fenced the sovereign and then worked our way around that. The second thing that we focused on was not to socialize the losses of the private sector, and that's why the banks went into liquidation. It would have been extremely difficult for an economy of the size of Iceland to basically put a sovereign obligation on them or secure all their lending. It would not have been credible at all. So we split the banks into domestic and foreign operations, and we did this with an emergency law right after the financial collapse. And the Emergency Act was about taking over the operations. And we had to appoint a resolution committee to take control of the banks and to take on the powers of the shareholders. We guaranteed domestic deposits because that was credible. We had because we can obviously, as having an independent currency, we were able to back that up in the central bank. And the third thing that we did, we put in place capital controls at an early stage. There was such a pressure outflow, capital outflow pressure from the banks, and also there was a lot of carry trade locked in the country, the Glacier bond issuance. So in order basically to take control of the situation, we put in place capital controls. First just as like emergency measures, and then at the later stage we put it into legislation. So these were basically the first actions that we took in order to get control of the situation. The second wave of actions was basically that we went on an IMF program in November 2008. The second thing that we did, we had a very structured debt policy on everything that we did. We focused on the sovereign, we focused on the corporates, and also on the households. Because when you have a currency that depreciates like 50% like the krona did in 2008, the household debt also went up because it's indexed to the inflation, and it goes, when the currency is depreciates, it feeds right into the inflation and the household debt goes up. And you can just imagine when the currency depreciates like that. Then we addressed the failed estates with specific measures. And then the offshore krona holdings that I just mentioned. We had a lot of issuance of the so-called Glacier bonds because we had a very high, the central bank had a very high policy rate due to how strongly the economy had been growing. Just to name the numbers here, we had an IMF program that amounted to 2.1 billion, and then we had bilateral loans from the Nordics, Poland and the Faroe Islands. And we actually never drew on these loans at all when we had the IMF program. The IMF program was focused on three basic elements: the exchange rate, to stabilize the exchange rate, and then of course the financial sector, because we had to restructure the whole financial sector, and then on the fiscal policy, because it was pretty evident that we would go into a lot of debt as a result of this. A lot of obligations had to be funded. And remember that the net government debt at that time was almost zero. So we were able to take on some new debt as a result of this crisis. I hope I'm not making you very depressed, because there is a happy ending to this story. Everyone is so serious. So one of the first things we did was basically you need to restructure the financial system. It had to be sliced down. And it went from basically being like 10 times GDP to two times GDP. And now it serves the domestic market. It's obviously not as international as it used to be. And this was obviously a necessary operation in order to get control of the situation. There was a very strong view that we had to get control of the treasury debt at an early stage. And the IMF was very focused on it. What the IMF did in our program, what was new, we didn't start with any austerity measures from the beginning. It was in year two, not in the first year. And I think it was also necessary to get like a social consensus on the program. And I think we've seen a lot of the new IMF programs are focused on that you can basically just not cut social welfare costs and services that people in the relevant economy are used to. So when we were working on the program, it was very important that the ones that came from the fund, they understood this. Because if they had put pressures on us basically to reduce the healthcare system that we have or the education system very dramatically, we would have had very strong resistance to the IMF program. And also we felt very confident that we could basically address this issue, because before 2003 and 2004, Iceland's economy was very sustainable. I mean, a healthy economy with a sustainable balance of payment. And as I mentioned, it was very important also for us to address basically debt at an early stage, because if the economy is basically be suffocated by debt, it's not going to grow. So the government debt, since we were at our darkest stage, which went up to 90% of GDP, is now well below 60%. And we just introduced like a 5-year organic budget plan in the authorities, and we envisage that the government debt is going to go under 30% of GDP in 2020. There was a massive debt restructuring taking place in the banking system as regards to the corporates, because the corporate had a lot of FX debt on their balance sheet, and in order for them basically to survive and work for the economy, their debt had also to be reduced. And it went from being like 260% of GDP to almost 100. And the same thing applies for the households. The household debt went up to 128%, but is now around 80%. And this was done both with specific measures. Households that had debt over 110 loan-to-value, they got debt write-downs. And also there was a general debt relief program with the government that corrected the household debt over the inflation, like a 15-year inflation or so. And also the household started to use the savings to pay down household debt. And just to show you the figures, basically how the development has been, the government still owes quite a bit, and the interest payments are still high. It's the third or the fourth largest costs to the government. But we have a very strong policy to get this even further down. You can see how the development of the corporate debt has been, and also of the household debt. Another huge challenge that we have was basically how to solve the capital controls. We had fully liberalized our capital account at an early stage, and it was very difficult to put the capital controls in place, but it was necessary because the balance of payment pressures coming from the failed states and also from the offshore krona was extensive. It was almost the failed states that had unhedged obligations was about I would say like 30% of GDP, and then the offshore kronas like 15 or 20% when we started removing the capital controls. At an earlier stage, it was even higher, the offshore kronas. Just to show you kind of the economic threat of possible capital outflow pressures. So you can see here on the gray sheet is the unhedged domestic assets of the failed states that were still in the country, and then the offshore ISK. And this is the foreign reserve that we had to work with, even after the financial crisis, how to address this challenge. And in order for them to kind of understand the challenge that we had, they also had a lot of foreign assets. We put in place a strategy that was two-folded. One was we introduced the so-called stability conditions to the failed estates that if they were willing to write down a lot of the ISK unhedged obligations, lengthening the their loans to the established financial institutions that they owned, plus repayment of the loans that the authorities had lent to the banks at that time, they would get exemptions from the capital controls. And they were willing to fulfill these stability obligations because otherwise we had put in place a stability tax that they would have to undergo in order for them to go out of the economy. Pretty unconventional, but completely necessary in order for us to have a sustainable balance of payment going forward. Just to show you the offshore ISK krona assets that were locked in the economy. This is the so-called carry trade that started from 2005 to 2007. It was almost 40% of GDP at its height. Yes, I'm not going to go into it. This was the biggest political debate in Iceland for years, the Icesave dispute. And if we would have added the obligations coming from, if this would have been a sovereign obligation, we would even had a more challenging task ahead of us. But fortunately, this was viewed to be private obligations by the EFTA court. So I've showed you basically the challenges that we had to deal with, and also some of the unconventional policies that we put in place. And now I want to show you where we are today. The economy has been growing very well throughout the last years. We envisage that the economic growth at the year end 2016 is going to be close to 5%. We have a very good current account surplus, low inflation, but that's also related to that there's very low international inflation. Very low unemployment rate. Latest numbers, as I just said, are around 2%. And significant debt reduction has taken place throughout the last years. We've seen the real exchange appreciate quite a bit, I think almost 11% since January. And we've seen a very rapid change of the net international investment position, going from minus 120% of GDP almost to a balance. We used to be in the same place as Greece and Cyprus, but because of these debt reductions and how we have addressed the failed estates, we've been able to move very quickly on that front. And we've started to see a lot of FX inflow, and that comes from the tourism has been booming in Iceland for the last years, and also other foreign direct investment. And we just got on, we're back in the A category. I don't know if I should now be concerned because we used to be a triple A. This is a bad joke, but now we're back to the A category as a result of the economic policies that have been put in place and the strong economic growth and the significant treasury debt reduction that has been taking place. And also the capital control strategy that we just embarked on and we've been working on since basically 2011, and then we renewed it in 2015, has received very favorable views from the rating agencies and the IMF. As you can see, this is this shows where how the GDP growth has been developing, and also how our gross debt has been, the general government debt, and in comparison with other countries. This is the current account. It was, as I told you, there in minus 26%, which was completely unsustainable. Now we have a good current account surplus, and the exchange rate has appreciated quite significantly in recent years as a result of where the economy is. This is the net international position, which has dramatically improved, which is very important for a small open economy. The inflation has been low, but there are other contributing factors, not just what is taking place in Iceland. We actually have a pretty robustness in the economy, so the central bank has been very concerned that we're going to see the inflation take off, but it has been lower than expected. And because of tourism and other inflows, the net foreign reserve has increased quite a bit, especially the unborrowed part. But even though it has increased like that, still the challenges of removing the offshore krona holders was quite significant. Because we've also had capital controls on all residents and corporates, and they've not been able to invest abroad since 2008. But now with the gradual removal, we've started to work on that. I also want to mention that the external conditions have been very favorable for Iceland for the last years. We've seen this growth in tourism that I mentioned. Oil prices have been low, which has been helpful for the inflation. And commodity prices have been favorable. We've had one of our key export sector is fishing, and the price of fish has been very high throughout the last years, which has helped our terms of trade. So these basically last 8 or 9 years have been very interesting, to say the least, as I've been trying to show you on this small road trip. But have we learned anything, and what have we learned? I think one of the key issues that we focused on ring-fencing the sovereign, was very important, just to get all the policymakers in the government on the same page, to make certain that the sovereign would not go under. And it's very difficult once you had to start sovereign debt restructuring to get a momentum within both within the economy, even though the market often forgets the challenges and it quickly recovers. But it was very important for us to make certain that the sovereign would not go under. The capital controls were important for us, very unconventional, but it gave us some breathing space just to realize where we were and just to sort out the failed estates. Because when you are a small open economy, you don't realize basically what can go out unless you put a little bit of a stop in order to analyze the assets and see basically the unhatched ones that could destabilize the currency market. One of the things that was very valuable for us, that most of the, or almost all the key policy decisions taken in Iceland, they were based on extensive balance of payment analysis. Because, as I said, if you don't really know what kind of obligations can go out through the current account, it can have devastating effects on your currency. Another issue, there was a very strong political ownership throughout and across party consensus on many of the decisions, especially the ones related to the capital controls, either to tighten them or to loosen them. The authorities, both the previous government and the current government, tried to inform the opposition parties as much as they could in order to get this consensus. The same thing applied when we had the IMF program. There was a very good cooperation between the authorities and the IMF on what direction the program was going towards and how the challenges facing it. You could also see there was a lot of domestic engagement with the economic policy. For instance, with the when we had the ICESave dispute, there was basically a grassroots movement that was kind of challenging at that time the current government when the government wanted to, it came to an agreement with the UK authorities and the Dutch authorities. There was a ICESave movement basically saying we should challenge this because it's not a sovereign obligation. And it actually ended up in two referendums, the agreements that were made with the UK and the Dutch authorities, and the result of it were two no's. And it ended up in an EFTA court. Another important factor, which I don't know how much is being, I mean, it is being discussed quite extensively, but it's the capital flow management. I mean, how is a small open economy, it doesn't just only apply to Iceland, but other small open economies with independent currency, what kind of an influence does excessive capital in and outflow have on the real economy? And I think a lot of economies are now realizing both the advantages and to a greater extent the challenges involved. And we just realized this already because the recovery has been quite extraordinary. We've been receiving a lot of capital inflows recently, buying into government treasury bonds. And we've actually increased the reserve requirement in order to put a little bit of a break on this inflow because it's a short-term inflow and could destabilize the economy. So that's one of the key lessons for our economy. Yeah, nobody can see this. So it's basically, you know, there was a big collapse in 2008, and with devastating effects with the currency depreciating about 50%, and with all that. And then the key thing was to ring-fence the sovereign, in my view. So these are, this is my lecture on this road to recovery, and I'm glad to take any questions that you might have here.
Thank you, Minister, very much indeed. There are already hands going up. What I suggest is that we might take two or three questions at a time, if that's okay.
Sure.
Can we take the gentleman here, please? There's a microphone coming. If you can simply say who you are and then the question.
Yeah, Bernard Casey. I was in Iceland in the year 2000, the last time there was a currency crisis. I remember it well. I was there with Joe Stiglitz, no less. And I was taken by what you said about before 2003, 2004, we had a sustainable economy. The banking system was enormous. I remember doing a Big Mac test, and I was living in Paris and working for the OECD at the time. And I had the view that I ought to be shipping Big Macs from Paris to Reykjavik because I could sell them at an enormous premium. There was a grossly overvalued currency, and everybody
yep.
was aware of this. On the morning that I was in the central bank, I think 40% of currency reserves were sold off in one morning to try and support the currency. So I don't think it was a sustainable economy, and it was not for a very long time before that. So I could ask the question the Queen asked when she came to LSE, why didn't people see this earlier? Just as a question, you said everything is much better now, unemployment is right down, debt has gone down. But what has actually happened to living standards, GDP per head measured in some sort of PPP basis, now compared to where they were, and can we see that over time? Because how well have the population come out of this other than that some of them have got their jobs back? Thank you.
Okay, good, thank you. Can we take the lady here, please?
Anna Tsiftsoglu. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the LSE Hellenic Observatory. I'm doing a research, comparative research in Greece and Cyprus after the crisis. So hearing stories like these, it's fascinating from a comparative perspective. So my question has to do with, do you think that the fact that Iceland was not part of the Eurozone actually helped the country to recover? Because I tend to think of Greece and Cyprus, especially Greece, it's never going to recover because the cost of, they would never let the banks fail, they would never, they would always socialize the cost and all that. So if you took Greece and Iceland into comparison, would you say that Iceland actually recovered because it was it retained more sovereignty compared to other Eurozone countries? Thank you.
Okay, those are quite big questions. Do you want to answer those now, then, please?
Yes, I'll start with the sustainability of our economy. And you mentioned, sir, that it was not sustainable in 2003. I think in 2005, you might rather be referring, were you there in 2000?
2000, and there was a collapse of the currency.
In 2000, yeah.
40% of
So basically what I'm saying is, like, because of our export industries in Iceland, the balance of payment going forward is sustainable because of the fishing sector, because of the energy, the tourism, and now the innovation, sector. And this has been, even though there are a lot of imbalances, and there will be imbalances oftentimes when you have pressures going forward, but overall the economy is doing well, and it has been doing so, even though we've often seen, like in many other countries, when there is an exogenous shock, you will see the currency depreciate. I think also in 2000, this was around the tech bubble. A lot of movements, capital in and outflows, were taking place in various other economies. So there were a lot of jitters in the market, as I remember this. I was a student at Columbia at the time, and I remember I could almost not afford to buy a burger in New York City because my currency had depreciated quite significantly. But the overall structure of the economy is pretty strong, as you can see with the key numbers I just showed you. As regards to the...
Sorry, Minister, if I could perhaps just pick up on the question. I understood the question to be, why didn't people see it coming?
Oh, yes, why didn't people see it coming? I think that a lot of us saw it coming because of the imbalances, but I think it's more the question is, why wasn't this addressed at an early stage? There was a lot of belief that the market would correct itself, that we wouldn't have to do all these significant adjustments, like putting in place capital controls, et cetera, et cetera. And this also, the banking system grew extremely fast in only a few years. Now, just with one acquisition or a merger, you can see, because the base is so small, this happened very fast. We should have addressed it, without a doubt, more efficiently in order to prevent such a development. That's clear, and everyone knows that, and that's why we had a change in government in 2009 as a result of that. As regards to the PPP, we've had just in the last 3 years, the purchasing power has increased about 20 or 24%. So the real wealth of Icelanders has been growing, and their equity and their housing has also been growing. And I think generally people feel that, but this was obviously a big economic shock to everyone. And you can also see just with the development of the household debt, how that has been increasing. The question on was it better for us not to be in the Eurozone? Yes, I think so. It was better as regards to the adjustment of the economy, and a lot of it went through the exchange rate channel. And I think also with some of the decisions that we took, for instance, the emergency the Emergency Act, and put the banks into liquidation, we were able to do it in a very short time because even though we have, seven to eight political parties in Iceland, they all agreed that this was a necessity in order to basically get control of the situation. I think if we would have been a part of the Eurozone, it would have been much more of a coordination and would have been more difficult to take such a drastic decision, let alone to have the IMF approve of it, because there were a lot of creditors that lost significant amount of money when you have such a situation, which was extremely unfortunate, but necessary at the time. And I think also, to a certain extent, it helped us when we were at the IMF program. There was a very active dialogue between Reykjavik and Washington, and I think the decision making was faster because it was less complicated. But there are also challenges that a small open economy faces when you have such a small currency. So that's why I was focusing on the capital flow management and how important it is to look at the capital flows in and out, which more and more countries are doing these days.
Thank you. More questions, please. Can we take the gentleman here?
Lucas Bierberger, I'm a student here at LSE. You spoke a bit about that there were two referenda on the issue, and in general that I had the impression that the public discussion on this, in my opinion, pretty intricate, complicated economic issue was very active. So
yes.
I would like to hear a bit more about how, from a policymaker's perspective, you explain these things to the general public and how public discussion on these complicated issues takes place.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And then there's the lady behind you.
I'm Sara Caputo. I work at ABRD. You mentioned the creativity, need for creativity when there is such a massive crisis. So I was wondering what's your view about the possibility of shifting from a full reserve system, from a fractional reserve system to a full reserve system. Iceland is one of the few countries that has actually analyzed these options, so I'm very interested in your view. Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? If you take the. Oh, thank you.
Hello. Thalia Matsioglou, visiting fellow at the Hellenic Observatory. You mentioned that you have now about 2% unemployment and a very strong labor market. And last year, the Greek Minister of Economy was here, and he mentioned that we have 50% unemployment in Greece for young people. And I work personally on the way they view democracy, and see that somehow this huge unemployment has affected a lot also other views. Apart from tourism and fishing industry, how does this strong labor market sustained in Iceland?
Good. So first of all, how do you communicate complex policies in a crisis?
Yes. There is a lot of public debate usually in Iceland, and this issue was of such nature because it was a lot of foreign obligations that the sovereign would take, and because of the economic collapse or the financial crisis, there was already a lot of discussion on, you know, what we should do. There was a consensus on the Emergency Act and the approach to ring-fence the sovereign. So we had communicated that very clearly at an early stage, directly and indirectly. So when this claim came about, a lot of, and it was very difficult also, the international communications between the UK, Iceland, and the Netherlands at that time. So the grassroots movement basically said, so it's not clear that this is a sovereign obligation, so why are we going to take it on? Because this was a private bank that put in place these obligations, but not the sovereign. And this would have been a debt burden going on for at least 7 to even maybe a longer time. So this also just came from a kind of a grassroots movement. A lot of economists, mathematicians, and just the general public, they had views on this. And I think it didn't also help that there was a terrorist act put on Iceland. I think that also made a lot of Icelanders, I don't know if Gordon Brown can really come to Iceland after the whole thing. So that was also an issue that moved people. The authorities didn't really they didn't do it in a structured way. It kind of just came from, you know, grassroots movement. And I think one of the kind of the phenomenal thing about how the resolution took place. On
moving from the reserve system.
There's a lot of discussion taking place on this in Iceland. We just had a conference the other day. The authorities have not put in place any policy making on the topic, but it's very much alive. There was the chairman of the economic committee, the parliamentary economic committee. He has been working on this report and introducing it, and it's just extremely interesting. And we are looking at options, but it's not a public policy at this point. It's more like at a discussion point and looking at, you know, the pros and cons. So why is the labor market so why we have such a low unemployment? There is a strong service sector too in Iceland, and the innovation sector has also grown after the financial crisis quite rapidly. Startups, because of the currency, they have used when the exchange rate was this low, a lot of new entrepreneurs came about. And obviously, when you have a very large banking system that fails, a lot of people became unemployed. A lot of our engineers and mathematicians that were working in the banking system, they put up a lot of startups. And there has always been a lot of energy in our economy and a lot of will to work and use the opportunities that are at hand.
Thank you. So there are careers for unemployed bankers. And that's good. Other questions, please? I'm tempted to ask about Brexit, yes. Minister, because, you know, this is a significant local difficulty that we have. And we're particularly interested in relations with the European Union. I wonder, as an EFTA member state, what your reaction would be with various options being explored by Britain post-Brexit. Would you welcome Britain back into EFTA?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, very good.
I've received this question on a few occasions. The way that we are viewing it, and when I came into the ministry in April, one of the first things I asked about, so what kind of a work are you guys doing as regards to a possible Brexit? Because we need to be prepared for a Brexit. Because even if the vote is not going to be a Brexit, then we don't need to do anything. But so the preparedness has to be focused on Brexit. And the way that we are viewing it, the UK is our largest trading partner. 11% of our export and import goes to this market. A lot of fish export. There's a lot of also cooperations, resource cooperation, a very important trading partner. So the way that we are addressing it, there are basically three options. Now I'm just talking about our relationship with the UK. there would be done a deep bilateral free trade agreement with the UK that would cover a lot of the single market that we have, because we have very good access to the UK through the EEA agreement and the single market. And secondly, that the EFTA country would make an agreement with the UK. We're chairing the EFTA right now, Iceland, and I put it as a priority to analyze the possibilities that EFTA had on this front. And then thirdly, that the EEA countries would come in on exit agreement that the UK would do with the EU. But obviously, we follow this. We have good connections with the current government. But it's difficult to see exactly what kind of a route the UK is going to take. But for us, it's very important that we continue to have the same relationship that we have with the UK. It's very important.
Mm. At what point do you think those kind of questions of Britain rejoining EFTA or the EEA, at what point in the sequence can those negotiations really take place? Must they be after 2 years of Article 50 negotiations?
Well, I think it's more of a question to the EU, but I would think that the number of people working in this area within the UK government must have increased substantially, because the options are they're numerous, as you said. But the authorities here have indicated that they're not so interested in an EEA or an EFTA membership. However, the UK used to be an EFTA, as you might very well know. But I think that if the UK authorities are interested, they've already started working on the pros and cons on both items. That's how I understand it.
I'm sure you must have had a very interesting conversation with Boris Johnson.
Yep. Jumbo FTAs.
I'm sure that must be possible, surely. Can we take the gentleman over here, please?
Hi, this is Vijark. I work at Wells Fargo Securities. I just have a question about the current setup of your financial system. Who are now the major players in the banking system? Does the government still have controlling stakes in them? Does the central bank have any say over management? And going forward, how do you plan on keeping the banks from getting out of control and growing to an extent where it all goes boom again?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And can we take the question over here, please?
Hi there. My name is Hanna Fríkisdóttir Kasarani, so by that name you know I'm Icelandic, but I have lived here in the UK for over 30 years. It's very interesting to have someone summarize everything that, as an Icelander, I've been asked since the crisis. But the one thing that we haven't touched on here, which I'm asked constantly about, is how come Iceland has managed to jail its bankers? Jail its bankers. And what's the sort of government perspective on that?
Mm. Okay. So the banking system and jailing bankers.
Okay. Yes. Should I start with the difficult one? No. So as regards to the ownership of the banking system right now, the state holds almost 100% of the shares in two of the major banks already. One is privately owned by the creditors of the failed estates. I envisage that this is going to be one of the key issues going forward for the new government, how we want to go about the structure of the financial system. I don't envisage that they're going to be privatized with a kind of a rapid privatization. It will be a very gradual process that is very transparent and has a lot of trust with the general public. As regards to jailing the bankers, why has Iceland managed to do so and other countries not? I haven't done any kind of a comparative study on this issue, but one of the key accounts that the Icelandic bankers were jailed on was market manipulation. And they were able to, the prosecutor's office was able to prove that, and that's not legal, and that's why they basically went and got sentenced on those accounts. I've been so busy in Iceland, I haven't really followed the cases and why this has not been the case in Ireland and in other countries where you've had banks fail.
Other questions? Perhaps I can ask one last question.
Sure.
Of my own, and it connects to this point about the response to the crisis. We've seen in Iceland grassroots movements, the protests this last spring against the government. And I wonder, as you look at the society before the crisis and now, is Iceland a more divided society today than it was in 2007? You refer to the government's response to the people on the streets. This suggests a responsiveness, but it also suggests that the people were really rather angry and divided and bitter.
I think that Iceland is it's a more critical society. I mean, before we had the financial crisis, Iceland had been, we had our exogenous shocks, depreciations, as the gentleman mentioned, and challenges, but not of this scale. So a lot of trust became an issue. So, and to a certain extent, we have an interesting society today, because people, they question what they see in front of them, which I think is healthy to a certain extent, to challenge what the authorities are saying or what the professor is saying or you know, etc. So to a certain extent, it's more dynamic, but it's also very responsive in the way when they see an issue that they, which are to their dislike, they go to in front of the parliament and raise their voice. So there is more, what can I say?
Assertiveness.
Yes, yes.
Well, and we must give the last question, because it's part of our LSE tradition, to the gentleman here.
Thank you, Kevin. Kevin knows me far too well. Actually, I wanted to follow a question which was it's Kevin's, not his last question, but his previous question, and it also relates to the question which Anna next to me asked. At one stage in the course of this crisis and its resolution, there was a discussion about Iceland joining the European Union.
Yes.
And that was seen as one of the solutions. Now, that solution appears to have disappeared at some stage. With the answer that you gave to my colleague here and to some extent the answer you gave to Kevin, can you go back to what was the relationship with the EU, which was sort of seen as one of the possible solutions but now appears to have been abandoned?
Just recall that I told you that Icelanders are more critical today than they used to be. So I think that's basically how the application was withdrawn. Well, this was maybe a bad joke, but the authorities at that time, they applied for an EU membership because one of the main reasons that they wanted to have a more stable currency. I mean, it's always going to be in such a small open economy that is prone to exogenous shocks because of a rather undiverse expert base, that this will be a challenge. However, the coalition parties at that time, only one of them, the Social Democrats, wanted to really to apply for an EU membership. And there was not a vote on the possible membership, so there was a lot of critical discussion taking place, grassroots critical discussion on applying for an EU membership. So they were never able to finish the negotiations with the EU, and it had been promised that the whole deal would go under a national referendum, but before that came about, there were elections and new authorities came into power that were not in favor of EU membership. But we were also criticized as we withdrew the application, not through a national referendum, but basically with sending a letter to Brussels, which was completely, what can I say, was sufficient to do according to the government. But now there's not a lot of general support for an EU membership. But there's still, of course, and there will always be a discussion, a currency discussion in Iceland. But I think generally that Icelanders are comfortable within the current economy that we have. But there will always be discussion on you know, the future relationship with Europe, in the sense that Europe is our largest export market. We export over 80% to Europe. So it's not in our favor at all that the EU is weak because of the importance through us. But in my view, it does not serve our interest to be members of the EU, because we have the EEA agreement that is working really well in our favor, and we have access to the single market.
Thank you very much indeed for a very informative lecture and very topical. Can you please join me in thanking Lilja Alfreðsdóttir?